Welcome, everybody, to this episode of Ocean Science Radio, the podcast that brings you the latest, greatest, and sometimes deepest stories from the ocean. Today, we are doing a holiday spooktacular with Sharktober. We are talking about sharks, and I would not be able to talk about sharks, really, without introducing my awesome co-host, that is Frances Faribault.
Hi, I'm Frances, shark biologist, aquanaut, and all-around nerd. We are joined this week by Melissa Marquez, who is a fellow shark scientist. Hi, Melissa.
Hello. How's everyone doing?
We're doing pretty great. So along with being a shark scientist, you also are a bit of a science and ocean and shark reporter, right? You do bylines for Forbes and a couple of other publications?
Yeah, so Forbes Science will be the one that I usually do, that I'm a contributor for, and I've been doing that. Ooh, I think 2 years now.
That's an awesome byline to get. Can you tell us a little bit about your background? Like, what'd you study? What do you like to talk about? What is interesting to you about the ocean?
Yeah, so I am a shark scientist, like you guys have said, and I specifically look at shark habitat use, so figuring out why sharks are where they are, but also looking at our relationship with sharks and how that's changed over time and how our perception of these animals sways conservation initiatives, whether our attitude towards sharks leads to more successful conservation initiatives or more failures in these conservation initiatives. So that's what I study for. And I write quite a lot about these relationships with sharks and these cool discoveries that we have about sharks, because I think by showcasing them outside of Hollywood media as these, what they do usually is these mindless, man-eating, killing machines, instead of showing that, I want, through my work, to show the cool, the wacky, the weird stuff about sharks, as well as the uplifting stories and things that give us kind of hope. And so usually on Forbes, I write about discoveries from all around the world that kind of make me pause and say, whoa, that's awesome.
Yeah, I was noticing a few of those. But before we get to that, what, you don't like Sharknado?
Do you know what? I do, because Sharknado, one of the movies was actually filmed in Universal, and I used to live down the street from there, which was pretty cool. And I will give Sharknado this. Some of their movies have wonderful shark diversity in them. So, A plus for that.
Nice. Frances, do you have any favorite shark horror films or things like that?
I can't actually say that I've seen Sharknado or any of the sequels.
There was a lot of drinking for seeing Sharknado, so I don't actually remember seeing them. I just know I did.
Fully fair. I also have seen only about... I've seen all of Jaws, but not all sequentially. It's one of those movies I've seen in bits and pieces. So I feel very underqualified to talk about the merits of the various sharks in films and media.
So I guess if I was to mention Deep Blue Sea, that would probably just be thrown right out of the window.
That's the one where the meme of Samuel L. Jackson. Is that that one? That's literally the only thing I know about that movie.
Oh, yes, that is exactly. Yep. The storyline is that, they somehow, I forget how, put a human brain or give a shark the ability to think on a human level, and it goes mad and eats everybody. And what's interesting for me about this is you look at all these different fantastic, crazy stories that Hollywood puts together, and then you turn to what you cover, Melissa, and there's just these weird stories that, as you said, make me go, whoa, about sharks. First up, I'd love to talk about the pink manta.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so this sounds like a comic book character name, the Pink Manta.
Or it sounds like a women's dive gear company.
Nice. Yeah, definitely. So can you tell us a little bit about this? What was this?
So it's funny that you say comic book, because this Pink Manta is actually named after the Pink Panther movie. And this Pink Manta is named Inspector Clouseau, and it is the only pink manta in the world that has been recorded. So this was actually first spotted back in 2015 by a dive instructor, and it's part now of the University of Queensland Project Manta. And they've been studying Inspector Clouseau for a few years. And to kind of give people an idea of what this pink manta is, I mean, it's bright pink. It's like if you took a highlighter and the whole white part of a manta, you just colored it in this bright pink highlighter. And so a lot of scientists at the beginning thought this was due to like some sort of skin infection, but they've actually taken biopsies of it. And in a 2016 study, I wanna say, the Project Manta was actually able to rule out any infection or even diet as a possible cause for this color. And instead they just think it's an unusual and unique expression of the melanin in this animal skin.
Yeah, when I first saw it, my first thought was like, wow, it looked almost looks like a sunburn, you know, when I go to the beach and just completely forget sunscreen for a few hours.
Yeah.
But it has nothing to do with diet. Like from your article, there was the thought that, you know, like flamingos, it could have been eating a certain type of krill or a certain type of crustacean and getting that pink coloring, but that's been ruled out as well?
Yeah, that's been ruled out as well. It just seems like it is an interesting expression of this melanin. And usually for manta rays, the other kind of skin coloration that we see is them being completely black as well, instead of that kind of famous black and white coloration. So this is just another one of those interesting melanin expressions, essentially.
One of the interesting things about it was that it kind of went viral, and a lot of people were spouting thoughts like, oh, this is obviously fake, etc., etc. You kind of touched on that in the article too.
Yeah, so I mean, it's one of those things where it does look like it's been photoshopped just because of how bright pink it is. But you know, a lot of people have seen Inspector Clouseau around Lady Elliot Island, which is on the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. So, you know, they can vouch that it's not a fake, that Inspector Clouseau does look that pink and that it's real.
Yeah, and if I recall correctly, for this story, you brought in Dr. Solomon David, the GAR guy.
Oh, yeah.
Anybody on social media, if you want to learn anything about gar, which are a specific type of fish, I forget if it's gar or gars. It's probably just gar, isn't it? This is your go-to person. And I will tell you, the gar puns are endless.
They are amazing. I will say that. I feel like there's a gar pun that I could do right now. All I can think of is gargantuan.
Our gargantuan amount of gar puns?
Yeah, there you go. A gargantuan amount of gar puns you will get if you follow Solomon David, who's an aquatic ecologist at Louisiana's Nicholls State University. He's great, and he believed that the mutation in the manta was something that's called erythrism, which is like an abnormal redness that can be seen in animals on their skin, or for birds and for terrestrial animals. It could be like on their fur or on their plumage, so their feathers.
So your other article that was really awesome was the article about the skinless sharks.
So for those who don't know, it sounds fake, but there was a shark that was found with no skin-related structures. So that means there was no epidermis, there was no stratum laxum, there was no dermal denticles, and there was no teeth discovered on this shark. And this shark was commonly known, we know it as the black mouth cat shark, scientifically as Gallius melanostomus. So they're a small little shark that's found in the eastern Atlantic, and they're usually found on like the continental shelves and slopes. So like a deep water-ish shark.
So we're talking no skin at all.
Yeah, no dermal denticles. Like I said, none of those skin-related structures, which is really interesting. And you know, funnily enough, I asked the lead author, I was like, what was your reaction when you saw this animal? And it's like, you know, the first reaction was a big surprise. It's not something that you expected to kind of see. And it was super strange, and they thought, oh, maybe it's just like a weird looking new species. But when they checked the different records and they did a bit more research into it, it was shown that it wasn't a new species. It was just this weird black mouth catcher.
The question that hops to mind, because if someone is imagining an organism that has no skin, first of all, great for the Halloween episode. Second, feels like there has to be some health implications for not having any of the structures associated with the skin. Obviously, a shark skin is very different from human skin. We don't have dermal denticles, which, for those of you who don't know, is this... It's called denticles because they're like this sort of teeth-like structure that gives that shark skin that sort of sandpaper-like texture. And also helps with hydrodynamics and helps prevent parasites and all sorts of really cool stuff. But it would be difficult for a human being to walk around and to be healthy without any skin-like structures. It's a large, very important organ. How's the shark doing? Is it okay?
Well, I mean, it's dead now because it was captured.
I mean, understood, but the...
But it seemed to be doing fine, like, according to the researchers. So that was a female that actually had developed gonads. So it was, like, an adult. It was doing all right. And like you said, you would think, like, how is it going to survive with such a severe issue of not having skin? I mean, dermal denticles and not having teeth, those are fundamental for so many reasons. So you would think that it wouldn't do well without it. But yeah, it was fine. Now, it does have a type of skin, obviously, because it, like, where are the organs and stuff going to go? It's not just free-floating. But its skin was very thin and smooth and translucent. But it didn't have those dermal denticles that sharks have. So that was, like, one of the biggest things. But yeah, it's really, really interesting. And it seemed, because it had, when they opened it up, its tummy was full, so it was able to eat prey. It was able to grow normal. So yeah, it's a really, really big mystery as to how the shark really was surviving.
So question on this, and you mentioned that it had developed gonads and was an adult. Did we think that this one reproduced? Because if so, then that genetic anomaly could be passed through the gene pool, right?
Possibly, yeah. I'm not sure if it was mature enough to have been able to reproduce. And especially if you look at how some sharks mate, I feel like this shark would have died if anything tried to mate with it, just because for a lot of species of sharks, the male sharks usually hold on to the female pectoral fins or those side fins to kind of keep the shark still. But the female shark will have tougher dermal denticles. It'll be thicker in that area to kind of counteract that. But because the shark doesn't have any dermal denticles, it has that thin, translucent skin. I feel like if anything tried to bite into it, it would be a bad time. So I don't think it reproduced. And I'm not sure if the researchers were able to figure out whether or not it could have reproduced. But if it did, yeah, we might have another skinless shark out there.
Spooky. You know, you talked about health implications, and Francis, you brought this up too, but like skin, along with just like being tough and being kind of like an armor, it protects against things like disease, bacteria, all sorts of stuff. There was no evidence on this thing of like infections or that. It was just perfectly healthy.
No. So you, like you said, you would have thought it would have had like a weakened immune system because it doesn't have any of these structures. But the observations of what was published, and the author himself said that it didn't compromise the animal. So it was really, really interesting to see how it was doing all right. And one of the things that I would have thought was, oh, it was definitely going to impact its health, like how it eats. But the lack of teeth doesn't seem to have been a problem for this animal either, because black mouth cat sharks tend to swallow their prey whole. So... yeah, I guess this shark is really lucky that it was a black mouth cat shark and not like a great white.
You've given us a lot to think about already. You know, it's definitely spooky Sharktober spectacular themed. We're getting a lot of these crazy stories. Right now, we're going to take a short break and hear from another member of the Speak Up for the Blue Network. And we'll be right back with more weird and interesting stories with our guest, Melissa Marquez.
Is the state of the environment getting you down? Is all the bad news in the newspaper making you miserable? Is your work environment making you unhappy? Do you want advice to help perform more effectively in your conservation job? Then sign up for the online Mindful Conservation Conference, 4th to the 9th of January, 2021. Go to absolutelysmashingllc.com to book yourself a seat for this virtual conference. Those booking early can do so for the bargain price of just $20. So come and join us to make yourself a better, more happier you, so you can help save the planet too.
And now, back to our show.
So, Melissa, the other story that I wanted to talk about with you was this story about the dermal denticles on the eyes of whale sharks. So we talked earlier about what dermal denticles are, which are these sort of skin structures on sharks, and they're called dermal denticles because they're like teeth. And so the sort of byline of this is that whale sharks have tiny teeth on their eyeballs, which is very Halloween themed. But it's slightly more nuanced than that, as you might imagine. There aren't just teeth sticking out of whale shark eyeballs.
Yeah, a new study has come out that whale shark eyes are covered in dermal denticles, which I think is probably one of the most unique mechanisms of eye protections in vertebrates that I've read of before. But it makes kind of sense as to why the scientists were kind of looking as to how do whale sharks protect their eyes. Because if you've ever seen a whale shark, their eyes kind of bulge out a bit. And they're a really big animal and they're constantly at the surface of the water. So you want to make sure, you know, that their eyes are being protected because there is quite a lot of junk that kind of just floats up there at the top, such as marine pollution. So I think it's really interesting that they've evolved to have this kind of protection on their eyes instead of, say, like eyelids or a nictitating membrane, which is like a third eyelid membrane.
And that would be something you would more commonly see in sharks. So most sharks don't have eyelids, but what they have is that nictitating membrane. So if you've watched Nat Geo or Discovery and seen that sort of slow motion image right before the shark bites into something and you see the sort of whiteness enclose the shark's eyes, that's a nictitating membrane.
Yeah, so some can roll their eyes to the back, some have that nictitating membrane, that third eyelid kind of in a way. And to my knowledge, I don't think there's been research done of whether those nictitating membranes are covered in dermal denticles, but this one for whale sharks was, which is really, really interesting. It's really, really cool that they have this kind of eye protection, and the eye protection in sharks really in general has been pretty much largely uninvestigated. But yeah, it's really, really cool. And yeah, the whale shark can also rotate its eyeball back as well, but they do have that novel sort of protection, which I think is really awesome.
And to get a little bit more into the weeds here, because I'm a shark scientist and I believe one of the things that was really interesting about the story scientifically is that a lot of people, because with the traditional view, because whale sharks are filter feeders, so they sort of swim with their mouths open and filter plankton and other floating matter and eat that in the ocean, is that vision is perhaps less important for these animals than it is for other more predatory shark species. But having developed this or evolved this unique protection suggests that vision is not at all unimportant.
Yeah, I think one of the kind of theories that a lot of shark scientists had was because if you look at a whale shark and then look at its eyes, the eyes are quite small for the rest of its body size. Like compared to the rest of the body, their eyes are quite small. And so a lot of people did think that they had poor vision or relied very little on their vision. But this new kind of research and the authors dispute it, saying that these protective features for the eyeballs seems that there is quite an importance a vision for figuring out, you know, what kind of prey there is, environmental perception in general. So I think that's really, really interesting. And it's definitely something that needs to be looked into more.
So how exactly did scientists figure out that there were tiny teeth on whale shark eyes?
They went around and they did two different things. So one of them was they looked at eyeballs of sharks that were out in the wild, but also in the aquarium in Okinawa. And they also looked at the morphological aspects of a preserved eyeball that was in one of their research centers in Okinawa as well. And that was a dead whale shark eyes that were caught as bycatch, I think, in Japan and was donated to the aquarium. They looked at the eyeball, the preserved eyeball, did experiments to document eye movement and retraction of whale sharks from the aquarium and ones that were in like open water fish pens that are near the aquarium. So they're not exactly like free swimming ones, but they're ones that they could monitor. And they were able to kind of check out those eye rotations, check out them rolling them back into the eyes. And then of course, have a closer look to that formaldehyde preserved eyeball and look at the structures under like a microscope and whatnot.
This episode is all sorts of spooky. We're talking about skinless sharks and eyeballs in jars, just all over the place, Halloween-y.
It's more spoopy than spooky because sharks are
spoopy.
You know, we love sharks here, so we're not at all. Perhaps it's a very unique perspective coming from two shark scientists, where we're not creeped out by dermal denticles or sharks.
We're an interesting breed, that's for sure.
Indeed.
One story that came up relatively recently in the shark world that I would love to talk about because it's topical, because it touches on the hot button issue of COVID, was the allegation that for a COVID vaccine, there would be a need to harvest livers from 500,000 sharks. Did you all see this? Did you all hear about this?
Yes.
What is going on here?
So essentially there's this substance that's produced in sharks' livers called squalene, and it's used in a lot of products. But for vaccines, it could be used as an adjuvant, which just essentially makes the vaccine more effective. And there's a worry, this is a substance that you can produce in a lab, but that takes more time and effort, and there's a worry that in the rush to create a lot of COVID vaccine that there could be lots of sharks killed to harvest the substance that comes out from their liver.
Yeah, you've said it best. You know, shark livers are considered one of the best resources for this compound. So a lot of people are worried that these sharks are going to be harvested for these vaccines. And at least some of the vaccines that are in the trials right now have an adjuvant that includes some sort of shark-derived ingredient. I think there's 34 candidate vaccines right now in a clinical evaluation, and like 142 different vaccines in preclinical evaluation, and five of them use adjuvants that are shark squalene based. But the problem, I think, with these numbers is that it's difficult to know how many animals are being killed just for their squalene specifically, if the meat's also eaten, if the fins are also sold, like if the whole shark is being used, does that still quote-unquote count for it being used as squalene, essentially?
And it's important to point out that sharks aren't the only animal that are used, that products are used when making vaccines in general. Horseshoe crabs are also famously used. First of all, horseshoe crabs are awesome. They have, their blood is actually blue.
Blue blood.
They're also old enough that they're considered by some scientists to be a living fossil, which just means that they've gone relatively unchanged for a long period of long evolutionary time. Horseshoe crabs are really cool animals. Also, sometimes proteins from llamas are used. So sharks aren't necessarily unique in being animals that are potentially impacted by an increase in production of vaccines. But we should also say that creating a vaccine is important.
Oh, 100%.
And that right now there aren't like massive shark kills happening exclusively for the squalene that we know of yet. So I don't want to contribute to any kind of panic's the wrong word.
Anti-vax panic.
Right. I don't want to feed into any kind of like any skepticism about this vaccine process. But it's important that we're something that we're aware of, especially since the squalene can be gotten in other ways.
Yeah, it definitely has plenty of plant and animal sources. And, you know, shark allies who created the petition against using a shark-based or shark-derived squalene has even said in their petition that they're not against creating a coronavirus vaccine. They want a corona vaccine to happen. They just want to make sure that squalene is being sourced ethically and not just from shark. Even though there are other sources to get squalene from, it's not as easy or as cheap to come by as, say, like shark oil. So I do definitely think that there's synthetic alternatives out there that should be looked into.
And just, I think like most things, moderation is key and balance is key. So we want to make sure that we're sourcing things in a way that's going to be most effective in getting a vaccine, and also making sure that we're continuing to have these resources to pull from in the future.
I might have missed it, but did we go over what squalene is used for in sharks? Like what sharks use it for?
I mean, it's a compound of their oil. So basically, one of the big differences between sharks and bony fish are that they don't have a swim bladder like bony fish. So for sharks, they have a really oil-filled liver to be able to be buoyant in the water column. And so squalene just happens to be one of the compounds that is in the shark livers, in this oil, essentially.
Cool. Thank you for the science knowledge bomb.
No, you're good. But yeah, like's been said, one of the big questions that's going around is, are those shark ally numbers realistic? And these estimates are really tough to make. It really depends on what species would be used for this, how much liver squalene content there is, how these sharks are being fished. Like, you know, is it just for that squalene, like we said earlier? Or is it also for their meat, for their fins, for other aspects of it? So I think it's really impossible right now to answer any question about any exact number of sharks specifically killed for squalene. But yeah, I do think that the takeaway message should be, we shouldn't really worry that the coronavirus vaccines are going to result in a mass culling of sharks. And if a vaccine does come out, you definitely should get it in this dang pandemic.
Yeah, we want to stop socially isolating and actually see people in person again.
I was going to say, I want to see my family.
Yeah, I haven't hugged my mom in like a year. Anywho, enough on the depression of COVID. So your work as a science writer has brought forth a ton of interesting stories. You know, we highlighted a couple in this episode, but is there any story out of the last year around sharks that you think that, you know, we should not miss, that we really need to go visit or really need to take a deep dive in?
Oh, I think there's definitely a few of them, just because there's such really interesting stuff out there. One of the really cool ones that I think that I just did that's a little bit funny because it's not something that you expect from is a swordfish and a thresher shark. I don't know if you guys saw that on my page, but essentially a female thresher shark washed up on the beach and she seemed perfectly fine at first. And then they realized that she had this giant puncture wound in her body. And that came from a swordfish bill. And so it's just seeing like these weird interaction between these animals. Like, don't get me wrong, there have been reports of swordfish being quite aggressive towards a lot of different animals to kind of protect themselves, like sharks. They protect themselves notoriously from blue sharks, but they're also known to go against whales and sea turtles, sometimes humans, and sometimes even boats and submarines. But it's really interesting to kind of see them attack a thresher shark when they were about the same size. So according to the authors, it was kind of a harmless thresher shark. And that just happened, I guess, to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. So that was a really interesting one. Yeah, there's quite a few different ones out there that I think are just really cool, really interesting. And yeah, just need to kind of be aware of that's out there.
So are swordfish just kind of jerks?
I think swordfish are very aggressive and territorial when they want to be, especially if they're up against something that they seem as competition.
Melissa, is there anything else that you want to chat about before, you know, we wrap up?
No, I think you guys have a pretty good roundup of stories there.
Oh, well, thank you for providing 3/4 of them. Sorry, 4/5 of them, actually, towards the end. Yeah, you're a great science writer. You should keep that up, please. I really love reading your stories, really love what you catch, and following you on Twitter, it helps me to stay abreast of all sorts of cool ocean science-y stuff. So thank you for the work that you're doing.
Aw, thank you.
I guess we should sign off by saying, even though it's Sharktober, sharks are not something that you, the general public, should be scared of.
You're more likely to be killed by a chihuahua than a shark.
Well,
which is frightening for me because I just got a chihuahua.
Oh no.
I know.
Sure. And again, we should qualify that maybe that says more about the sharks than about the chihuahuas.
No, there's actual statistics about this. Like, you're statistically more likely to be killed by a cow than a shark.
A vending machine than a shark.
Yeah. Yep.
You're more likely, I think, to be struck by lightning twice. Right. Than be killed by a shark.
You're more likely to get bit by someone in New York.
Oh yeah, well,
than
that's yeah. No offense, New York.
We were going for something, you know.
Yeah.
Impressively long odds. Sharks are something to be respected and fascinated by. They're a source of wonder. And even though we have themed our Halloween episode around them, I think that we should think of them less in the Jaws, a deep blue. Deep Blue Sea, was it called?
Yep, Deep Blue Sea.
Deep Blue Sea, Sharknado sense, and more in a happy Halloween, Casper the Friendly Ghost sense, perhaps.
Yep, yeah, I definitely think that if this episode kind of shows anything, is that they're amazingly wonderful, wacky, mysterious animals that we still have a lot to learn from. We've just got to give them a fighting chance.
And with that, thank you so much to our guest, Melissa Marquez. Thank you so much for our other guests, the various shark species that were featured, and Elasmobranchs. Thank you to you, our listeners, for joining us on Ocean Science Radio. Don't forget to like, subscribe, share, talk about us around the virtual water cooler, etc. And be sure to join us next time on
Ocean Science Radio.
Forgot about the shark puns. This has really got me between a rock and a shark place. Stage awesome, everybody.